Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the Weft Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Sandra Otten, your host for IMC Radio News this week, May 10th. Yesterday was Mother's Day, and today we're going to start out with a poem that was written during the Civil War by Julia Ward Howe. And she actually founded Mother's Day with this poem. Not many people know, even pacifists or peace activists, that Mother's Day was actually not a overly sentimental Hallmark holiday, but rather a call for us to end war, for women and mothers to end war. So we're going to start out with that, and then we're going to follow it with a story that I'm reporting on the civil trials that are happening with regard to Brady Smith, who is a convicted child molester. This is a very interesting story and just shows the terrible injustices done through our state's attorney, John Pyland's office. It's got a lot of twists and turns in it. It's about a 9-minute story, so I hope you'll stick with me for that after the poem. And then lastly, we're going to hear from Mike Lehman of WRFU, IMC's latest venture. And that we're going to have low power radio here in Champaign-Urbana. And Mike Lehman is going to be telling us all about that. For IMC Radio News, I'm Sandra Otten. And here is this poem by Julia Ward Howe. Arise then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts. Whether your baptism be that of water or of tears, say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husband shall not come to us reeking of carnage for caresses and applause. Our son shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity and mercy. We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm! Disarm! The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after its own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and humanity, I ask earnestly that a general congress of women without limit of nationality may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient and the earliest period consistent with its objects to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interest of peace. The This week, Judge David Bernthal is hearing a civil case where the plaintiff is asking for compensation from Champaign Schools and Brady Smith, a former dean of students at Franklin Middle School. Brady Smith was, in 2001, convicted in criminal court for trying to get young boys to have sex with him. There are four other civil cases pending with similar claims. All the victims are black men who were, of course, children at the time of the incidents. Brady Smith is white. The suit claims that Smith sexually groomed and sexually abused male students, and the school officials failed to protect the students. My primary source of information on this story is the News Gazette. The story, however, bears repeating in its entirety so that we can try to understand the circumstances that led the Champaign County State's Attorney, John Pyland, to believe that the public interest was best served by Smith receiving no jail time, 3 years probation, and a fine of mere $10. Why would he allow the prosecuting attorney, Elizabeth Dobson, to drop another solicitation count and more serious charges of aggravated criminal sexual abuse and attempted criminal sexual abuse? According to the News Gazette, November 14th, 2001 edition, quote, State's Attorney John Pyland said his office's objectives were to see that Smith was convicted of a serious felony, that Smith wouldn't teach again, and to have a deterrent effect of others. He is also quoted as saying, "This is not a mere slap on the wrist. It was career death penalty." Further quoting, as part of the settlement worked out by Smith's attorney, Sullivan, and Assistant State's Attorney Elizabeth Dobson, who has personally known Smith for years, Smith will not have to pay a fine. It was agreed that the bulk of the $25,000 cash bond posted by his mother and stepfather to gain Smith's release would be returned to them after court costs were deducted. End quote. According to the News Gazette in the September 13, 2003 edition, Elizabeth Dobson was for years a friend of Smith during his employment as a Champaign County probation officer. Brady Smith was a Champaign County probation officer from 1985 to 1994, working most of that time with juveniles. He was also a coach at Urbana High School. He was employed as a Champaign County Unit 4 employee as of 1994 as an alternative education teacher, and at the time of his arrest as dean of students. In addition, he was a foster parent. The criminal charge that Mr. Smith was convicted of stems from soliciting a 14-year-old boy to have sex with him on May 20, 2001. He was convicted in November 2001. The trial was a stipulated bench trial. This allows an agreement to be reached between the prosecution and the defendant. But unlike a guilty plea, the stipulated bench trial preserved Smith's rights on appeal and in future civil litigation, such as the civil litigation he is going through now. In the civil trials, the one that is being heard this week and the four that will be heard later this year, the basic same set of facts are being alleged, that between 1997 and 2001, Smith cultivated the trust of young, vulnerable African-American boys, cultivated their trust by giving them gifts and spending time alone with them, and then engaged in sex acts with them. After the conviction in the criminal trial in 2001, presiding judge J.G. Townsend ordered Macon County probation to monitor Smith's 3 years probation service. This was because, although Smith lived in Urbana, his previous employment with Champaign County probation might have undue influence. This brings us to August 12, 2002. Smith had been convicted already. He had got his sentence, which was 3 years probation and the $10 fine, and the civil suits were pending but had not yet been brought to trial. In 2003, then, three Macon County probation officers went to Smith's home and on a scheduled visit and announced that they were going to search the house. They found a small box containing 50 bullets in the bottom of a larger cardboard box in the back of a closet in Smith's bedroom. This violated the terms of his probation. Smith said the box was left there by a former foster child. It was never reported why the probation officers decided to perform what must have been a very thorough search. There was no report that they had any reason to believe that Smith might have unlawful material in his home prior to the search. Judge Townsend, in the probation revocation hearing, said that he believed that Smith's prospects for rehabilitating were poor. Evidence presented in the hearing indicated that Smith had contact with people under the age of 18. Smith admitted that he had contact with other young people at his home when he was on probation. Smith's lawyer, Sullivan, said the probation only prevented him from contact with three specific young people. Perhaps this engagement with young people, but yet not crossing over the line, was the reason that the Macon County probation officers decided to pursue any means necessary to get the probation revoked. That's just speculation. During this trial, Elizabeth Dobson, the prosecuting attorney, seems to have changed her thoughts with regards to whether or not Smith should be a free man. In contrast to her earlier agreement that allowed Smith to be free on probation and to not serve time for his crimes, now, according to the News Gazette, quote, Dobson argued that the evidence, including Smith's own testimony, showed that he won't change his attitude and thus posed a risk to the community. She repeatedly questioned Smith about whether he now admits that he solicited a child to commit sex, but he only said that he admits he was convicted of that offense, end quote. Judge Townsend sentenced Smith to 4 years in prison on this probation revocation. His projected parole date is February next year. He was taken into custody of the Illinois Department of Correction on August 2003. If he is discharged in February, as expected, he will have served less than 1.5 years in prison. When Smith had his probation revoked, he was charged with possession of unlawful firearms by a felon. For this, he was sentenced to 2 years, but John Pylon chose to allow the sentence to run concurrently with his probation revocation sentence. In the civil trial being heard now, Brandon Ward, who is 22, and his mother Kelly Ward are suing Smith and Champaign County Unit 4. At one point in the very confusing relationship between Smith and Brandon Ward, Smith called the Ward home and told them that he had given his car keys to the then 15-year-old Brandon. Kelly Ward testified that Brandon, then 15, had no license and did not know how to drive. According to the News Gazette in the Friday, May 7th edition, this was when the Wards first alleged that there was sexual abuse. Quote, evidence in the trial shows the allegation of sexual abuse were first made in October 1996 when Brandon, then 15, was accused of stealing Brady Smith's car and wrecking it. Smith was put on administrative leave for 2 weeks but allowed to return to the school after investigation by the Department of Children and Family Services and Urbana Police. DCFS concluded that the allegation was unfounded and that Urbana Police concluded that the allegation was unfounded. They concluded that there was not probable cause to arrest Smith at the time, unquote. According to the News Gazette, quote, Kelly Ward said she first met Smith at a meeting where Franklin school officials tried to convince her to put her son back in special education. Smith introduced himself and told her that he was glad to see a parent stick up for her child, she said. After that, Smith called their home and informed her that he was going to help her son with his homework. One Saturday morning, Smith was given permission to take Brandon out to breakfast, Kelly Ward said. After her son returned in the afternoon, she tried to ask about the breakfast with Smith, but her son immediately went up to his room, she testified. Unquote. There has been expert testimony at the trial that indicates that Brandon Ward was indeed sexually abused by Smith. Here the story takes an even sadder and ironic twist. Remember that first, according to John Pylon's dictates, child molester Smith would have spent absolutely no time in prison. The fact that Smith will spend any time in prison is largely thanks to the Macon County probation officers, and yet that time, according to the Department of Corrections, is less than 1.5 years. Yet Brandon Ward, a sexual abuse victim, was incarcerated in September 2000 on a possession of drugs charge, and with the blessings of John Pylon, sentenced to 7 years in prison. If he is granted all of his good time, he will have served more than 4 years when he is paroled in December of this year. For the Independent Media Center, I'm Sandra Otten. I'm speaking with Mike Lehman of the Independent Media Center and of WRFU. So, Mike, how would you describe your relationship to WRFU? Are you a founding member, or how would you?
I've been sort of an organizer of people interested in low-power radio in the community.
Okay. WRFU, for those of you who don't know, is a new low-power FM radio station that is going to be that is taking shape in Champaign-Urbana. And tell us the
the call letters are WRFU and the frequency's 104.5 FM.
Yeah.
And tell us just briefly how the process came to be in getting low power FM, or how you decided to pursue it.
Well, this started actually before the IMC, the fall before the IMC really got started back in the year 2000. A number of people in the community, different groups, were interested in low power. Pete Tredish from Prometheus Radio Project was kind of going around the country and talking to people. A number of us met with him. Originally, there were four different local groups that I'm aware of. There were also a couple of religious applications who I don't know anything more about than what's available online. But we all filed applications, but it ended up in the end that only a group known as Socialist Forum, which I'm also a member of, it's a non-sectarian democratic socialist group that is active in labor and community organizing in the area. We followed through with our application, and we ended up being awarded a construction permit back in December, and that gives us 18 months to build a station. So we hope to be on the air by June 2005.
How many, was there, what was the circumstances that led the FCC to make these stations available?
Well, actually, Paul Rismondel has a pretty good article that covers a lot of that that's on the front page of the May issue of the Public Eye. Basically, the FCC had years ago, under pressure in part from PBS, had tried to do away with a number of low-power licensing possibilities. Many stations went off the air at that point because they chose not to upgrade as required. And they basically left a hole in the spectrum where small community groups at one time, a lot of it included educational institutions, at one time had access to the airwaves relatively cheaply. Because the airwaves are public property, people just started saying, hey, you know, why don't we use this? And there, so there's a number of pirate broadcasters got started. And the pressure really grew on the FCC to do something about this. I mean, the space is available, people said. It shouldn't be a problem except for certain commercial and not quite commercial if you include NPR. But any case, pressure grew for communities to have better access to the airwaves, which are, after all, public property.
So you're saying that pressure grew, mm-hmm. but then there was some opposition from commercial interest and from NPR.
Right.
And they fought the FCC somewhat.
Yeah, that was part of the reason for the delay that took so long, is they took away a number of the channels claiming that there was going to be interference with these high-powered blowtorches of radio that they can afford. They thought that our little candle in the wind would somehow interfere with their broadcasting. It was a technically deficient claim, but they had enough pull for obvious reasons. Our democracy is oftentimes at the behest of big money and influence, and so Congress kind of took that away and forced the FCC to do some studies, which, as it turned out, showed that, well, guess what? There really wasn't any interference issue of any substantial portions.
Well, what about the number of licenses issued then? Does this fill the airwaves, or do you foresee that sometime in the future, I mean, is there pressure to, like, get a station now or never have one?
Actually, there are a number of licenses that they made available. About, I think it's around 300 maybe now stations are actually in the process of going on the air. Well over 1,000 people applied. Supposedly at some point they're going to open up another group of licenses for 10-watt stations. When that will be, we really don't know.
In comparison, how many watts then is WRFU going to be?
We'll be at 100 watts maximum.
And how many is WEFT?
I believe it's 10,000. I took the transmitter off the truck many years ago, so I'm vaguely remembering when we stuck it in the shop out there.
And that has to do with specifically then how far the broadcast will carry. So
yeah,
a 10-watt station basically is going to be your neighborhood. A 100-watt station could be Champaign-Urbana.
Right.
And then 10,000, like WEFT, could
be Decatur, Bloomington, mm-hmm. Danville, you know, depending upon when you get out that far, it gets a little iffy. Another important factor is antenna height, and I believe it's pretty much unlimited for stations like WEFT and bigger stations, of course, you know, within budget considerations. and FAA, you don't want to put it up there where it'll snag aircraft or whatever. But we're actually limited to no more than 100 feet above ground level. And since FM travels in a straight line, that's how it propagates, you have to have sort of a line of view to the tower in order to get reception.
Now, so something can't be, it can't have a building in its way. It's got to be up high.
Well, you'll get it bouncing around. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of technical issues. But what it does is it sort of limits the radio horizon to a point. As you know, if you're on level, flat ground like around here, and you can see to the horizon, it's about 7 miles. So if you raise an antenna up so far, you're going to get a little bit farther, the point of view. Actually, they say that we can get out roughly about 3.5 miles away from the transmitter site. So you have a circle that's 7 miles.
Where is that transmitter going to be for WRFU?
It'll be somewhere near downtown Urbana.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about how this station is going to be organized, how it's going to end funded. So you might maybe start with the funding.
The funding is basically we're going to solicit donations. This is where we're just getting started on that. Our overall budget is roughly $15,000, more or less. We've had offers of used equipment. Obviously, there's new equipment for sale. It's going to be a shoestring, though. And that's
so $15,000 is the money that you're needing to get the station
right
off the ground?
Basically on the air, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we're really hoping to have very minimal expenses. A 100-watt station doesn't require much power. Think of a 100-watt light bulb in your room. That's about how much power. Of course, you've got studio equipment, stuff like that to run in addition to the transmitter. But, we're hoping that expenses are at most a couple of $100 a month.
That's interesting. So you're not looking – I hadn't thought about that. So, like, WEFT, a large part of what – is required is mm-hmm. to pay for the actual transmitting of it.
For power, for your studio transmitter link, which we're hoping not to have to use. We're hoping our transmitter is right next to where the studio is, so we just run it in a cord out the window.
So is it right, really, that you're going to think that maybe you can really operate the station for $200 a month?
Yeah, actually, we're hoping that that's our eventual budget. We are really as station philosophy is to spend as little money as possible and to put as many community voices on the radio as possible.
Okay, so we'll talk about that. That's the station philosophy then. Mm-hmm. Who came up with this?
I think it's sort of a product of the way we do things at the IMC. We try to do things that put resources into people's hands, and obviously that costs some money. But the idea is that community resources are there and can be utilized. We think that there's enough people both in the community and enough free programming. There's just a whole world of programming out there that, you know, there's all, if you're on the air, it's 168 hours a week if you're on 24/7. And we think that there's plenty of more programming that people want to hear that would be valuable to people in the community.
Well, I think that's probably right, just from the fact that I like listening on the web, but I don't actually like listening on the web. It's just the content that I want.
Yeah, well, that's one of the sources.
Yeah, so like going to, for instance, Radio for All is a mm-hmm. place where I can listen to radio programs that
exactly.
I wouldn't hear otherwise. So is that a possibility for programming, or how do you intend to fill that 168 hours?
Well, one of the things is that we're going to, of course, have live on-the-air air shifters. But a part of the philosophy is to have it automated. There's all kinds of pretty reasonable cost available now, software and hardware, that you can automate a station. So the idea is that when people are available, they can go down, and when not, we'll flip the switch and go on automated. And what that does is it always allows us to have some flexibility to add new programming. When something comes up in the community, news or whatever, people want something broadcast, we can put it on. That's part of the way things will work. Things like Radio for All, they have an enormous archive. They go back to 1996. There's just all kinds of stuff available from them. There's something called WINS, which is the Workers' International News Service out of Madison, Wisconsin.
So, Mike, who will decide what programs get on the air?
Basically, the idea is to have programming groups of two or more people that will take responsibility, like air shifters do at WEF now. They will say, we're going to be responsible for 2 hours a week or whatever it is. And then they do their own programming. And the way we're going to decide that is sort of in a station meeting. This is basically the way the IMC works, where things are very, it's a very open structure. People are very much encouraged to do their own thing.
Will it be operated by consensus like the IMC is?
Yes, yes. In fact, that's written into our structure document, which we just approved, and there's actually a story on the newswire at the IMC right now. People want to look at that.
Right, so if people want to find out more about WRFU, they can go online and visit www.ucimc.org.
Yes.
How do you see it then as different from WEFT? Or let me ask you this. Do you feel like you have support of WEFT? Have you talked to the people, the station management or the board of directors? Or
yeah, all along folks at WEFT have been encouraging about this project. They're a member of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which unlike the commercial broadcasters and NPR, from the beginning have taken a position that more voices in the community are better. We intend, as soon as we get some money, we're going to become a member of the NFCB ourselves. I have gone and talked to folks, numerous folks informally, and the board of directors I talked to here about a month or so ago. Now, one thing to keep in mind is we can't have any official relationship with WEFT in terms of, oh, well, we'll put on X hours a year programming or anything like that. But in terms of people just helping each other out, that's totally cool. I mean, if folks wanted to somehow air shift at both stations, they got a lot of time, they have a lot to say, that's cool, but that's up to the individual folks that do, you know, the air shifting and stuff like that. There won't be any official relationship between us, but the one thing we've considered is, you know, there's no point in competing with WEFT. I mean, we don't want to put on, you know, the same music they're putting on, the same, you know, news and stuff like that. Although there's certainly, you know, some reason to like things like the IMC NewsHour that we're speaking on now, for instance, that could be replayed at a different time over, you know, at WRFU, for instance.
Right.
There's some of those things where I think there's enough interest in the community. But on the other hand, you know, we don't want to take away listeners from WEFT. We share a lot of the same values, a lot of the same views. We think getting those voices out there are important, and WEFT has far more reach than we ever will. So there's no point in really, you know, thinking of anything but trying to complement the effective work that WEFT has done for so long, just to expand the availability of that to other people in the community.
I've been speaking to Mike Lehman with the Independent Media Center's new radio station, WRFU. He is one of the people who are helping to get the radio station off the air. And again, if you want to find out more, you can go to the UCIMC website or read about it in the Public Eye this month. Mike, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Sandra.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Well, you have been listening to the May 10th, the Mother's Day edition of IMC Radio News. I am Sandra Auten. I am glad to have been your host and producer this week. I am solely responsible for the content. If you'd like to be involved in IMC Radio News, we are actively seeking volunteers, people with story ideas, people who'd like to take a microphone out on the street and get some sound bites for us. We have a variety of things that we could teach you to do and would love to have you involved. If you could give us a call at the IMC, 344-8820, and say that your message is for the radio group, you can come to our meeting on Tuesdays at noon, where we provide a nice vegetarian lunch at 218 West Main Street in downtown Urbana, or you can email us at radio@ucimc.org. Thank you for listening. Signing off for IMC Radio News.